Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, coming at you, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of dark energy. You've arrived at a nexus point, a crossroads of shadow and light, a phantasmagorical marketplace of ideas and blasphemies, a grand melting pot of cultures and subcultures, from the benign to the bizarre, all on the same path, searching for breadcrumbs of cosmic understanding and hoping we'll be able to follow the trail back to where we started. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. I'm very glad to be back with you once again. Folks, I'm telling you, summer is making its presence known. It's just past 10 p.m. here in Las Vegas, and the temperature is still hovering right around 100 degrees. It has been truly hot, and it has to be for the Weather Service to issue an extreme heat warning for Las Vegas. I mean, it's always a bit toasty here in the summer. Not for the faint-hearted, for sure. So when they issue a warning because the heat's going to be extreme, even by Las Vegas standards, you know it's hot. There were pockets around the southern part of the state this week where it hit 119 degrees. It was triple digits all week long. That's not 119. That's not the official temperature reading, but that's what unofficial thermometers showed, you know, right before they melted onto the sidewalk. I mean, it's too hot to fry an egg on the sidewalk. Eggs would rather be in a frying pan, I think. Anyway, I hope it's comfortable wherever you are. Gina, the producer, just told me it's about 90 degrees there in L.A., so that's pretty toasty there as well. And if it isn't comfortable where you are, get inside, crank up the A.C., and coast along with us for the next few hours. We kind of picked up some musical selections for tonight that are kind of summery, if that's a word, summery. Kind of songs you might listen to if you're laying in a hammock under a tree or had your toes in the sand on some beach somewhere. Not really official songs of summer, but just kind of breezy, I guess. And Jesse's in the control room queuing them up. Nothing breezy about tonight's guest, though. The books he has written are highly recommended, for sure. But they are not light summer reading by any means. Not something leisurely to read out by the pool. His name is Peter Lance. He's an award-winning journalist, investigative reporter, and author. He's made appearances on the show in the past, I think, with both George and Ian. But there is some urgency and special timeliness to having him join us tonight. This week, Peter Lance basically called out the most powerful and most feared federal prosecutor in the country. Lance basically challenged this prosecutor to come after him. He dared him. He drew a line in the dirt. He asked him literally to put up or shut up. In essence, come and get me, tough guy. At the heart of this simmering dispute between Lance and the prosecutor is the material we're going to cover tonight. And it's a part detective story, a part spy thriller, and in a way, it's a horror story, too. It's about a super spy who worked for none other than Osama bin Laden. The spy's name is Ali Mohammed. How he got into our country, joined the army, worked with the CIA, while still providing services and training to terrorists, including bin Laden, is astonishing, maddening, and I think sickening. And if someone had been paying attention to this guy, 9/11 didn't have to happen. This new book by Peter Lance is called Triple Cross. It is meticulous. It's well-crafted. It's like a modern historical treatise that reads like something written by Robert Ludlum. So coming up in hour two, journalist Peter Lance and a story that will drive you right up the wall. Plenty to talk about in news tonight. I want to start with a shout-out to the wild and crazy guys from First Class Limo in Cleveland, Ohio. Don't mean to give the company a plug, but I had some dignitaries from Las Vegas who were in Cleveland recently. They hired a limo, and their driver was just explaining to them that his entire crew of drivers listens to Coast almost every night in all their vehicles. And fellas, we appreciate your loyalty. We're only a few hours away from a momentous anniversary, 40 years since men walked on the moon for the first time in human history. And those of us who were alive at that time will never forget it. What a proud and glorious moment for our country and for the world. And then, you know, after a few more missions, poof, we gave up. Okay, we did it. We got there to the moon. That's that. Took our marbles and went home. Our space program today is a wreck. It's more of a jobs protection program than a space program. I mean, they start a project and cancel it. They start one up and cancel it again, and everybody stays on the payroll. Next year, according to this plan, anyway, we will essentially have no way to get into space anymore. The shuttle's being shut down, decommissioned, and as yet, there's no replacement. Nothing we can use to, so if we want to visit the International Space Station, for example, that chunk of metal up there that we put tens of billions of dollars into building, we're going to have to hitch a ride with the Russians or someone else, maybe the Chinese or India, one of those countries who thinks it's still a good idea to be up in space, to have a space program that does something. You know, it wouldn't be so bad if NASA would just quit and get out of the way. But as we know from previous interviews on this program with space entrepreneurs like Bob Bigelow comes to mind, NASA makes it hard for anyone else to get up into space either. They throw up all sorts of roadblocks to private enterprise so that the commercial development of space, which ultimately is what it's going to take up there, that's also stilted. It is hard to believe that 40 years after the moon landing that our space program is this bad. Now, I understand there are many folks who think that the whole thing was a hoax. We didn't really go to the moon. We never landed there. And I agree, there were some intriguing arguments in that regard. But, you know, in general, I think there are pretty good answers to most of those points. I'm hoping we are posting a link. I think Lex is posting a link on the Coast website under George Knapp's News. Nice alliteration there. That'll direct you to some of the sites where this theory is discussed, both sides. And, it's a theory that's been talked about a lot here in Nevada. A writer named Bill Casing, I think, is the first guy to raise this hoax scenario like 30 years ago. And Bill's idea became the genesis for the movie Capricorn One, which you might remember. A lot of those who subscribe to the hoax theory point to Nevada's Area 51 as a place where the hoax was most likely staged, you know, with a hangar made up to look like the lunar surface, sort of like a soundstage. There is a Nevada connection to the Apollo program. Apollo astronauts trained for their moonwalks in the barren and nasty deserts and out in the craters of our state. And they were out at Area 51 for a time for some training, according to pretty reliable reports. If there is a conspiracy theory about the moon program that I like, it's the one that suggests the astronauts really did go and that a few of them saw something strange during their missions. UFOs, things on the moon, things that really scared them out of going back. And it's always seemed interesting to me that Neil Armstrong, the first man on the moon, has practically been a recluse since leaving NASA. I mean, earlier tonight in Washington, he joined his crewmate Buzz Aldrin at this big gala to mark the occasion. It was held at the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum, very cool place. Armstrong did speak to the group, and I thought when I read the story, wow, Armstrong spoke in public. Oh yeah, he spoke all right. He spoke for about 11 seconds, and that was it. It's very strange. I mean, this is a pretty big anniversary. Couldn't Neil Armstrong muster maybe two paragraphs of material? Ah, well. Journalism giant Walter Cronkite died this week, as you all know, and several Coast listeners sent me links to a story about Walter Cronkite, who was a big supporter of the space program, how he had his own UFO sighting back in the 1950s, a story he supposedly told to a few people in the early 70s while he was working on this UFO program for CBS News. And Dr. Michael Sala, who was our guest on Coast to Coast a few months ago, wrote this story about Cronkite's UFO sighting, and it's an article that so many of you forwarded to me. The problem is that Sala's chief source for this story is a guy named Bill Nell. And as you all know, the UFO field attracts all kinds, and more than its share of crackpots and con men. And you've got to go a long ways to be considered wacky in this field, and Bill Nell is, how should I put this? Not widely regarded as a very credible authority about UFOs. He's been around the field for a long time, but he's best known for selling the work and research products of other people without permission. And in this case, Mr. Nell tells a story how Walter Cronkite supposedly confided in him right off the bat about his own UFO sighting, hadn't told anybody else about it. Dr. Sala reported this story as told by Mr. Nell, but now he regrets it after receiving this flurry of emails from all over the UFO universe about Bill Nell. Sala did further research, and he now disavows this story entirely. He suspects that Mr. Nell is working with some other guys in this field who have been known to dish out a lot of nonsense, maybe on purpose, maybe to make a few bucks, whatever. In any case, thanks to all of you who sent me that article, but I honestly would not want to put money on it, and neither would Michael Sala. If you want to talk about someone at the other end of the credibility spectrum, someone who oozed credibility and honesty in UFO research, is Richard Hall, Mr. Hall died this weekend, and it's a real loss for the research community. He was one of the original members of NICAP back in the 50s, a contemporary of Major Don Kehoe, involved with the Fund for UFO Research, wrote some great books, classic books, really held people's feet to the fire about bogus UFO claims and cases. Richard Hall was a giant in our field. Our regrets to his family, including his extended family in the UFO field. Time now for a short break. When we come back, a note about the CIA assassination squads and a giant asteroid slams into Jupiter. We'll be opening up the phone lines in this hour, and then at the top of hour two, we'll be joined by journalist Peter Lance. Stay right there. I'm George Knapp, and Coast to Coast, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. Glad you're with us this evening. My thanks to all the listeners who've sent me articles about the 12-mile-long pile of black goo floating off the coast of Alaska. Mercifully, not all of you included jokes about Sarah Palin along with the photos and articles, but quite a few of you did. I'm going to spare the rest of the Coast audience some of those comments. And what's up with the sea creatures? What have we done to get them riled up? Several of you sent me news stories about the attack of the giant jellyfish. Coastal villages in Japan being devastated by these giant jellyfish who really seem ticked off about something. Sounds like one of those old Japanese sci-fi movies, but it's real and is underway right now. And then off the coast of Southern California, it's squid. Large squid have invaded. They've been attacking or otherwise harassing divers and swimmers, tearing up on the beaches, scaring the bejesus out of people. And you have to wonder, are they working in conjunction with these jellyfish? Is this a coordinated assault? Inquiring minds want to know. And of course, I'm joking about that. Crypto news from around the world. Crop circle season in full swing right now in England. And there's an unusual assortment. I mean, there is a usual assortment of hoaxes by people who have nothing better to do. But there's also an unusual assortment of really strange formations. As you know, some of these agroglyphs don't look like they're made by people with boards strapped to their feet. Our friend Linda Howe sent us some amazing photos of what might be the most incredible crop formation I've ever seen. This pattern looks like it was weaved by somebody. Now, how a hoaxer would pull this off is really a mystery, especially since they had to do this in a very short period of time. There were people out there in this field before and right after this thing appeared out of nowhere. Our webmaster Lex has put this and a few other items of interest up on the website. Take a look and tell me what you think about this. Also there are some unusual photos that might be of interest to Area 51 fans. These photos were snapped 2 days ago here in Nevada by a Nevada resident who saw this odd column of vehicles coming down Highway 93. And that's the rural highway you would have to take to get from Las Vegas up to Area 51. Anyway, these shots show this large, round, saucer-shaped object being carted on the back of this huge flatbed truck. And this object, whatever it is covered up by a tarp. It's kind of army green colored tarp. There's a little gap in the tarp, and it looks like what's underneath is made out of metal. You know, maybe it's just someone is messing with us, pulling our chain, hauling this thing down in broad daylight down the road. My first thought was it might have been one of these giant tires that they use up on these huge earth-moving machines used in the gold mines up in northern Nevada. So you can take a look at the photos. Let me know what you think. And thanks to the listener who sent them in. Also sent in tonight is a newsletter from Mitch Batros. He's been a guest on this program, I know, in the past. He says an amateur astronomer has snapped these shots through his telescope indicating a large asteroid has smashed into Jupiter a few days ago. Big black spot can be seen forming on the surface of Jupiter. Mitch suggests that all amateur astronomers out there might want to fire up the Celestron and take a look in that direction. Are you following this story about the CIA assassination squads? You know, we talked about it a couple of months ago on the program in reference to something that famed investigative reporter Seymour Hersh had said, almost in passing. Turns out Cy Hersh knew more about it than the director of the CIA, Leon Panetta. Panetta says he found out about this CIA hit squad plan in June. He put an immediate stop to it. It was in the training phase. He and members of Congress were pretty steamed about it since no one had told them this program had started up. And since then, we've learned the CIA was allegedly instructed by former Vice President Dick Cheney to keep their mouths shut and not tell Congress, specifically not tell them. It's quite a tale of skullduggery and intrigue. As you probably know, the U.S. supposedly put an end to officially sanctioned assassinations many years ago. That was in the wake of some hearings, high-profile hearings led by Senator Frank Church. And it's been the law of the land ever since. Another law of the land spelled out in very clear language is that Congress is supposed to be kept informed, kept in the loop about the activities of the CIA. You may not like that law, but it is the law, and there are good reasons that such a law was passed. Here's my take on this story. You know, it's one thing to have assassination squads gunning down foreign leaders or despots or tyrants that we just don't like. It's quite another to have teams looking for people like Osama bin Laden. And I don't see much moral difference between sending out armed assassins or snipers or ninjas trained by the government to kill people like bin Laden, or in the alternative, arming these predator drones with missiles and then blowing up the houses or cars, killing these suspected terrorists deader than dead. What the heck is the difference there? If we as a country have decided we're going to go out and kill these bad guys before they kill us, who cares if it's done by a hitman or a drone? What's the difference? That said, I do think it's a pretty big deal for the vice president to order the CIA to keep Congress out of that loop. You know, you may not like Congress at this moment. A lot of us don't, and there's good reasons for that. But that's our system of government, checks and balances. And Congress is required by our Constitution to keep tabs on the executive branch. So when there is a conscious choice made to just ignore laws in that regard, it's a serious matter. So it's going to be interesting to see how far Congress goes in investigating this stuff. This House committee says it's going to hold hearings, gather evidence. I can't imagine Dick Cheney agreeing to come in voluntarily and submit to questioning by a panel of congressmen. I can't imagine that happening. So it kind of sets the stage for a really interesting showdown. And we've posted an article or two about this story in case you haven't kept up with it. Also on Capitol Hill, another story we followed in this program, some good news. The House this week passed a landmark bill regarding wild horses. You recall we went into this in great detail last month when I was here with Madeline Pickens and Jerry Reynoldson. This bill would basically prevent the slaughter of horses that are now in government corrals, and it would add more land to the acres set aside for wild Mustang herds. And I think the House has its heart in the right place, you know, and the public has certainly spoken about how it wants wild horses treated. A lot of you folks who listen to those programs on Coast called in, sent messages and emails. But right now, here in Nevada, the BLM is gearing up for more roundups. They are essentially going to remove all the horses from ranges that were specifically designated as land that's set aside for wild horse herds. They're going to zero it out. The reason they use the justification is pretty weak, as it always is, seems to be for BLM. No one is stepping up to the plate, though, to stop it from happening. You can add all the acres you want for horses. And that's what this bill would do, I guess, assuming it passes. But unless someone talks to the BLM about stopping these roundups, it doesn't mean a whole lot. I don't know how this wild horse bill is going to fare in the Senate. I mean, the cattle industry has a lot of friends in that chamber. But if you were one of the many Coast listeners who sent messages to Congress about saving the Mustangs the last time, you might want to consider sending another one. So the Senate gets the same message from the public and doesn't pull a fast one in the middle of the night. I want to say a hearty thank you to the House, which voted overwhelmingly in favor of this bill, which at a minimum would put an end to these plans to kill 30,000 horses now being held in government corrals and pens and pastures. I want to return to the Crop Circle news for just a second and try to get one more story in before our break. This is a really weird story. This report comes from guys on the ground over there in England. It's an event that happened July 7th, Silbury Hill in Wiltshire, England, which is sort of the heart of Crop Circle territory. Same location where Crop Circle researchers have seen a lot of other weird stuff over the years. This bizarre event took place at 5 o'clock in the morning. A Wiltshire police sergeant driving his private car towards Marlborough on this highway, and was about to pass Silbury Hill on his left. He looked to his right, and he sees these three exceptionally tall beings inspecting this new Crop Circle, which had appeared there 2 days earlier. He stops his vehicle. He watches them for several minutes because they were odd. I mean, each one of them were well over 6 feet tall. They had blonde hair. They're wearing these one-piece white suits with hoods that had been dropped onto the back of their heads. After he watches them for a few minutes, he said they appeared to be examining the Crop Circle formation. He shouted at them from about 400 yards away. They kind of ignored him. And then he started walking toward them. As he enters the field, they became aware of him, and they ran away at what he described as an amazing speed away from the Silbury Hill. He said that he realized he could never catch up to them, so they ran so fast. So he glanced away for a few seconds, looked back to find where they were, and they'd become completely vanished. He became very uneasy and left the scene. Police officer says he was very aware of hearing this static crackling sound in the field around him. He said as the plants moved around, he could see the movement coincided with the level of the sound, as if the static was somehow affecting these plants by moving them. He also started to experience a headache out in that field, he said, which became worse as the day went on, and he couldn't shake it. Now, we've heard reports about this from those areas before. Never heard anything about seeing creatures, but certainly that static thing. Jimmy Buffett going to take us into the break with his song Boat Drinks. We'll come back. We'll open up the phone lines, and then Peter Lance at the top of the hour. Stay with us, everyone, on Coast to Coast. One other note about crop circles before we leave this subject. I think we're going to get this lady, Nancy Talbot, on the show sometime soon while the heat of the season is underway. Nancy Talbot is a well-known crop circle researcher. She sent me this note talking about National Geographic. I guess the National Geographic crew is making yet another program about crop circles. They do one every couple of years and always try to debunk this thing. And Talbot tells a story about being completely misled by these folks and how the audience is going to be misled as well, showing hoaxers who are pretending to make a crop circle for the cameras in one scene that she talks about. We're going to get her on the show maybe and talk about that sometime in the near future. A lot of you folks are already lined up on the phones, and when we come back, we're going to jump right to it. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast. Welcome back, everyone. My name is George Knapp. This show is Coast to Coast AM. We're going to the phone lines to see what's on your mind. Our wild card line, Doug in Portland, Oregon. Doug, how you doing?
Hey, sir. Thanks for letting me on the air.
Sure thing.
I was in Germany before 9/11, and a guy asked me to work for Osama bin Laden.
How'd this happen? How'd this happen?
We were driving to go get a horse lesson, and he looked at me and said he had a friend that knew where Osama bin Laden was, and there was a $3 million reward. If I wanted, though, I could work for him. It wasn't $3 million, but it was a lot of money.
That I mean, do you look Muslim or Arabic or?
No. I'm an American horse trainer, and I'm not Muslim.
Would have been tempting, Doug. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Would have been tempting to go ahead and play along and to see if you could find out where bin Laden is.
Well, I think you got me kind of silent on that one. But I think it headed that direction. I turned him into the head of security at the Frankfurt Airport. His name was Tony Granger. He was really a good guy, like a real hero. He sent me a text message on 9/11, and he did anyway, the guy I turned in, that saying he'd kill me. He advertised me exactly a month before 9/11 on 8/11. My passport was sliced open so he could take the picture in and out. He was friends of the Arabs in Hamburg. He gave me no specifics as far as a time or a plan. After the police raided him, he put on the German horse websites that I turned him in for being a Nazi working together with a terrorist. That was a full 2 years before the neo-Nazi terror bust in Belgium. I was in Spain at that time. I dared him to take a lie detector test at the United States Marine Base in Germany in front of the Marines. Someone told me that if I did that it would come out, and I could, you know, it would come out. And his response was to send me one back saying that if I take one step on German ground, I'll hear the cuss from the clinks of the police, and not only the police want me so much.
Well, that's a heck of a story. You know, the scary part of it is that Germany, France, Spain, Italy, all those countries, Belgium, I guess, as well, have major populations of potential terrorists, jihadists, people who don't like the West, hate America, probably don't feel too good about Western European governments either. I mean, large communities of these folks. And did you see evidence of that? Are you still there, Doug?
Yes, I did. Are you there?
Yeah. Well, thank you for the call. Yeah. That's an interesting story. You ought to... I'm sorry?
He wanted to make sure America got a black eye before the generation we beat in World War II, the Nazis. He wanted to make sure that the last of them saw America get a black eye. And so my hope would be that the Americans that fought in World War II would be able to know that it got the other way around.
Well, we all look forward to the day when somebody tracks this guy down and brings him to justice. Thanks for the call, Doug. Wildcard line, Tom in Staten Island. Hi, Tom.
Yes, George, great show. I just have some information regarding Peter Lance's book. It's a wonderful book, but the only one thing is a reservation in there. On page 428, he talks about Gregory Scarpa Jr., okay? And he's quoting Larry Silverman, who was the lawyer for Gregory Scarpa Jr., that he said he was never convicted of a homicide. He was never convicted of a homicide, but Gregory Scarpa Jr. pled guilty to manslaughter along with Gus Ferrace and two others back in the late 70s. They used to make sport of going over to the village and kidnapping gays. And they brought two gay boys out to Staten Island at Wolf Pond Park, and they proceeded to have them sodomize them. And then they tried to – they beat one to death, and they thought they beat the other boy to death. But he crawled up into someone's house, and they subsequently indicted them for homicide. And these punks got off with 3 years, all right, for manslaughter.
Well, for benefit of our audience, Scarpa Jr. is a guy we're going to be talking about later in the next hour with Peter Lance. We're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but I guess your point, Tom, is that maybe Peter Lance is splitting hairs here. I guess technically he's right in saying that Scarpa Jr. was not convicted of homicide, but he pled down to manslaughter.
Yes, in a brutal murder.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what I'll do.
And then his compatriot, Gus Ferrace, in the 80s, murdered a DEA agent out here on Staten Island, which shut down the whole mob in all of New York City. They brought in federal marshals, FBI agents. You might want to discuss that with him. They subsequently, Scarpa Sr. Was the one who was able to find out where Gus Ferrace was hiding, because the mob was after him as much as the feds were after him. And then they put a hit on Gus Ferrace, and they finally got him over in Brooklyn, and they rubbed him out before the mob could get him.
Tell you what I'll do, Tom. I'll bring this up. It's on page 428. I'll mention it to the author as soon as we get him on the air. Thanks for the call. Wildcard line, Jack in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Jack.
Hi, George. You're doing a good job tonight.
Thanks.
As always. I just want to say that anyone who has any doubt that we went to the moon should have seen the MythBusters program a few months ago, where they went up in the Vomit Comet and did the parabolic flight.
Right.
And simulated to a T, 1/6 gravity. They lined up that footage along with the actual moon footage, and you could not tell the difference. So anyone who thinks we didn't go to the moon should see that, because there's no way they could have brought a whole studio up into the sky to fake a moon walk. It was absolute 1/6 perfect gravity.
I took that that zero gravity flight out of here in Las Vegas last year. Wow, it's quite an experience. It's a tremendous, it's a very expensive little undertaking, but if you can afford it, it's very cool. But I got your point. I don't know how they would fake that in a studio, because the film surely look like they are in some kind of lessened gravity situation. People raise some pretty good points about this stuff, and I've never heard a really good answer to the one about the shadows going in different directions in some of those photographs. But I know there are answers to it. I just don't happen to know what they were. Jack, thank you for the call. We're going to go east of the Rockies to Marie in Reading, Pennsylvania. Hi, Marie.
Hello. I'm one of those people who have a question about whether or not we went to the moon. Oh.
Okay, fair enough.
I saw a program last week. I don't remember what channel it was, maybe the Science Channel. And one thing that makes me extremely suspicious, they lost the film.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
NASA lost the film. As far as him saying he saw the original film, the ones that they're using now was CBS's or something like that, and it's very grainy and you can't see very well. Now, doesn't that sound strange?
It is astonishing that NASA could be that sloppy. I guess maybe back in those days they were actually doing actual space work and putting vehicles up there, so maybe their minds were on other things. But gosh, that as an historical document, it's priceless. You would think that they would hang on to it.
I haven't called for a long time. I haven't called since Mike Siegel and Barbara Simpson were co-hosting. And it's really hard to get on the phone. I have had several UFO experiences.
Right.
Where, like one night, my dog whined that he wanted to go out. So I tied him outside. And then he started barking. Well, I don't let my dog bark outside. I went right outside, and the sky was completely black, completely black. You didn't see any stars. But I saw this one white puffy cloud, and it was brilliant white, and I thought, oh, the moon must be behind there. And then I had to turn around almost opposite direction to unhook his chain, and I saw the moon on the other side of the sky. And I thought, what the hell is that over there? Because that looked like a cloud. And I watched it move across the sky, and it was almost like in a straight line, like it went behind a building, it disappeared.
Well, you had an experience similar to what a lot of people have reported over the years. You've had several of them. I think, Marie, maybe they're attracted to you for some reason. You should grab a camera and hold it with you, carry it around with you at all times, so the next time it happens, you can document it. Good idea?
I was told by someone I saw it going out of our dimension.
Well, that's a hard call to make, I would say, but I'm very glad that you got through on the phone, and thanks for listening all these years. Thanks very much. That was Marie in Reading, Pennsylvania. We're going west of the Rockies. Lonnie, right here in Las Vegas. Hi, Lonnie.
Hi, how you doing, George?
Okay.
I've got a couple of interesting points, so I'm not going to be too long about it, and I don't think anybody's going to get very upset about this, but I looked at YouTube. They had pictures of this blob stuff up in Alaska there.
Right.
And when I looked at it, it looked just like the algae I used to see back home when I was a kid in Iowa when we went fishing. Same color and everything, same makeup, same gooey-looking mess. It would grow at the edge of a pond, not fresh water like a river, but a pond, and it would be stagnant water, shallow water, and it would grow in there very, very thick and bug you when you were trying to pull in a fish. And then the other thing I'm going to bring up is in 1968, I was going from my parents' house in Colorado to Camp Pendleton, California, and while mapping out my route through a road atlas, I saw Groon Lake there, plotted out there in the Nevada desert, and it was colored purple, which meant to us folks that read military maps, it was an impact area. So I just assumed it was a bombing range. So that may have been a myth, too.
Well, you know, that whole area has been a bombing range and the testing range that was, you know, it's right adjacent there to the Nevada test site where they blew up all sorts of bombs. And Groom Lake itself over the years was bathed in radiation in the early days of the testing, the above ground testing program. So it probably was rightly called a bombing range, but it's been a long time since they've done any bombing out there, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, this was 40-some years ago that this happened. I just got home from Vietnam and was had orders to go to Camp Pendleton. And then the only other thing I have a question about is what government does the BLM work for?
BLM is part of the Department of Interior.
Yeah, but whose government? They don't seem to have our welfare in mind.
They sort of march to their own drummer, I think. I think their constituency is not necessarily the public, but it's other folks.
Yeah, I'll go along with that. Okay,
all
thank
right.
you very much.
Thanks, Lonnie. First-time caller Patrick in Idaho. Hi, Patrick.
How you doing?
Okay.
Good. I'm a remote viewer, have been most of my life. I've worked in the aerospace industry for the last 25, 30 years. I've worked for four of the intelligence agencies, including the Office of the Geographer. And I'm just kind of getting annoyed at all the separation and the camps between whether we went to the moon or not. The bottom line is, yes, we went to the moon. Yes, it was filmed on stage. The reason they did that is they were afraid of what they were going to find on the moon and what was going to happen. So they did a mock-up in case something went terribly wrong or too much was exposed. So that's basically the bottom line on it.
And that's a pretty interesting theory.
That's what happened.
Okay, so how do you know this?
I'm connected. I'm well connected.
I mean, did you access this information through remote viewing, or did you access these? You were part of this program, or
both. I was part of a small program, part of it, and when I hooked onto that, I did a lot of remote viewing. There's actually four of us that still remote view. and we're very connected, very good. I can actually see something. I'll start to tell the other person about it, and they will finish my sentence.
So, but back to this moon thing. Now, so you think that they did both. They filmed something, a fake version of it, so that because we were afraid of what we'd find up there?
What would be exposed up there?
What does that mean?
Let's say that we saw something in the background or something came through the viewfinder. Something happened during the filming, which it did, okay, a voiceover and so forth. How are they going to justify or bring to the American public and say, yeah, this was actually a UFO, this was actually a structure up here, this is what we found? How do they expect? They want to keep this covered up.
You know, what we've read over the years is the astronauts develop sort of a code word. They call them UFOs a Santa Claus. They veiled references to Santa Claus, right?
Right. They're there. I mean, the U.S. technology is so advanced that you would not believe it. There are things that come up through the patent office, come up through inventors that you never see, and the inventors kind of disappear.
You're saying we are up there? We're up there on the moon now? We got a base?
Yes and no. We've had people up there. There's some controversy whether or not some. You're really getting into an area here that'll take a lot of time to explain. But what's happened is there are those that would like to see us on the moon and displace those that are there now.
All right, back to this idea that you're connected. Meaning, can you say who you work for, or how you're connected?
I'm independent now.
Okay, can you say who you did work for?
I worked for the CIA, I worked for the Office of Geography, I've actually worked for the FBI, I worked for several others.
In what capacity? What'd you do for the FBI and CIA?
Basically, it was viewing and capturing to set up a scenario and say what was going to happen. I say, this is what's going to happen, this is where you need to be. They would be there, they would capture the guy, and that would be the end of it.
Wow. Patrick, send me an email. Send me an email. I'll send you back.
I tried to get through to George Norrie, quite a few times and can't go through it. If you want to know about the Mothman, I can tell you. The thing that I want to bring up real quick, if I may, is that people don't understand the emotional trauma that goes on with remote viewing. Most remote viewers won't talk about this, but there's a lot of emotional trauma that comes in with this.
I would imagine. I mean, it depends on what you're seeing there. Patrick in Idaho, thanks for the call. Send me an email. I'll get back to you, okay? We're going to try to get one more call in before our break. Rusty in Arizona on the wild card line. Hi, Rusty.
Good evening. How are you, sir?
Okay. How's it going?
I'm well. The problem we have here, the reason why we didn't go there, the technology of 1969 of the capsule and suits will not allow the astronauts to pass through and back to that all radiation belt without dying from radiation poisoning. And anyone from NASA, congressman, president, anybody wants to debate this, here's what they do. Tell them to put these suits on, go to Chernobyl, walk around for 3 days, and come back and talk at night where you can see them coming. And then the astronaut, Collins, the other guy, wants to always say he punched one in the nose. The reason why his mother committed suicide is he'd explained to her previous to the fact that this was going to be a staged event, and she was so embarrassed. That's what she did this. This is why she killed herself. And when he wants to argue this point, this is why he turned into a drunk afterwards.
And how do you know this as the reason for his mom committing suicide? Buzz Aldrin you're talking about?
Buzz Aldrin, exactly. Well, let me just put it this way. Why don't you get him to talk about it and ask him why his mom really committed suicide? He told her this was going to be staged and she wasn't going to go through the embarrassment. And after she killed herself and he went through this nonsense.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't have Buzz Aldrin here. I have you who's making this allegation, a pretty serious one, about this guy who's, many people consider to be American hero. So tell me, what is the source of your information that's why his mom killed herself?
It's very private. It's very direct. It's someone that's very close to the family.
Okay.
And that's all I can say about that. But like I say, why don't you face him off with that and ask him about it and watch him break down and cry?
I think that thing about the suits is a very good question. Rusty in Arizona, thanks for calling in. Thanks for all the rest of our callers. When we come back, we're going to talk with Peter Lance, author of the new book, Triple Cross. Stay with us on Coast to Coast.